Okay, we're doing almost parakimel today. In your chaverah, there's an article written by a person who I think rose at some point in his life to be the chief rabbi of South Africa. He moved from England to South Africa right after World War II and assumed the position as rabbi in 1946. He wrote a book called Out of the Depths, Mimamakim. It was a book written with the same title in Hebrew about Shabbos and Shubbos that came up to this rabbi while he was in the camps. His name was Ephraim Oshri, just passed away a few years ago. Amazing, amazing personality. The questions asked about the Holocaust during the war and after the war. First question in the book is, I have a big tattoo of numbers across my arm. The Torah forbids tattoos. Should I have it removed? It can be removed. He advised not to. He said we have to give testimony to what they did to human beings. That was the first tshuva in the book. Anyway, this book is written with the same title, but in English, Out of the Depths. And this was a book on about a 5 or 6 page drasha on each parsha. Right? And each one has some kind of social critique about what's going on in the world. On Parshas Kedoshim, which is the Haftorah Haftorah comes from Amos, he talks about the chosen nation of Israel. Israel is God's chosen nation. What does it mean? What obligation does that give to us? And he uses it as a social critique for what he saw was the ill treatment of blacks in South Africa at the time. The reason he picks up that, which is really way ahead of its time in South Africa, it's about 35, 40 years. Ill treatment of a person is ill whenever it's happening, right? So the reason for this being in Parshas Kedoshim, because the Haftorah Parshas Kedoshim, chapter 9 of Amos begins, Halo kivnei kushiyim atem li. You are like Ethiopians to me. What does that mean? So there's a Gemara in Maseches Moed test that says that it's a metaphor for something outstanding. Right? Kushiyim is not a people that the Israelites saw too often in Israel. And one person from Kushim means from a person from Ethiopia. Kush is the name of a person. He's one of the children of Chum. And he would stand out. So Gemara makes a drasha. You're an outstanding people. It's a very unusual way to say it. But the Gemara says that this is true about Moshe's wife, who's called Isha Kushit, according to the Gemara, and Shaul, who was called Kush Ben Yimini in the Pasuk in Tehillim. So the Gemara makes a drasha out of all three of them. The outstanding beauty for Zipporah, outstanding king for Shaul, an outstanding nation for Israel. To be sure, in all three of these instances, you have Pshat Meforshim, such as Reshbam, who say all three of them are meant to refer to Ethiopians mamash. Moshe married an Ethiopian woman. His sister didn't like it, so Hashem said, you don't like the fact that your brother married someone with dark skin, so I'll make your skin white. She specifically received a punishment. Not so much that's normally reserved for Lashon Hara, but that relates to skin color, right? Which is what Zoraz does. That's Reshbam's parish. I'm interested more in our pasuk. What does Amos mean by you are like Kushiyim to me? The author of this book, by the name is Louis Rabinowitz. Louis Rabinowitz says in this book, Out of the Depths, that, of course, skin color doesn't mean anything to God. I don't care if your skin is white or black. I care about your morality. Right? And the last line, remember, if you look at your chaverah, this whole article is in your chaverah, is that a moral Ethiopian is far superior to an immoral Jew. He really takes issue on his hands. He just arrived. I don't know why they didn't fire him. He had just arrived, and he talks about the earthy Jew, the Jew who only cares about enhancing his wealth, who goes to the racetrack to gamble, who eats pork, and he calls them swine-eating, flesh-loving. I mean, you have to see it. But he managed to keep his job, right? And he said that I don't see the morality in you. What I do see is immorality in how the blacks are being treated here in South Africa, right? And he says, God chose us as his nation to help others who are in need, etc., etc., and what does this have to do with Amos? Okay, Amos is the author of that statement, Halo kivnei kushiyim atem li. But more important is that earlier in the book, and right here in the beginning of chapter 3, Amos addresses this issue of the Israelites being God's chosen nation. Okay? And we're taking that up here in Perek Gimel. Right? It says, Shimu es devar hadevar hazeh asher diber Hashem aleichem bnei Israel al kol ha-mishpacha asher aleisim eretz Mitzrayim lemor. He mentions Mitzrayim because with the redemption from Egypt, I have the right to expect from you certain behavior that I don't necessarily expect from others. You are my chosen, and therefore I expect these things from you. Now, as you may know from third or fourth grade, any time one person stands out amongst others as a chosen, we call teacher's pet, that's likely to result in
jealousy
and enmity and hatred of everyone else in the room, right? So Amos is going to tell us how to avoid such calumnies, right? Might raise up a certain story and say preparations in your mind. Much more than with Yaakov and Esav and Yitzchak and Yishmael. It seems that the mothers get involved there to help the favored one somewhat, right? In the case of Yishmael, apparently he just accepted that and went off. In the case of Esav, he doesn't accept it so much because I feel tricked. But he does move. In Parshas Vayishlach, out to Seir, Mipnei Yaakov Ochiv. Perhaps as a result of the Bechorah that he sold, or as a result of the blessing that father said. Fine. But in the case of Yosef, there is no mother to stand in and to protect him, and Yosef gets the brunt of his favored behavior, right? Behavior status. One has to wonder how Yosef was so immature as to milk that status. And Yaakov, where were you? Right? You think it's just enough to say you think your mother and I are going to come bow down to you in order to discredit his dream? Right? Mother being dead already? Rashi writes that Yaakov was trying to tell the brother, come on, it's just dreams. He's just an immature kid. That's enough. You don't recognize that your sons harbor murderous intent about him? And you send him into the jaws of the lion? Right? Amos in this chapter 2 and 3, remember last week we talked about whether or not this is actually a reference to the sale of Yosef or just an awful, horrible practice of selling people into slavery if they can't pay back debt. Right? Something we see from Haftorah of Vayera, we just read a few weeks ago, was actually done. Right? Remember they took the woman's, wanted to take the woman's two children because her husband died and left debt. Right? It's disgusting. No fuss about that in the Torah. You only sold the slavery if you steal and you can't pay back. Not for debt. It's despicable. It's Maaseh Sodom. Right? So we discussed whether Perek chapter 2 and now leading into chapter 3 is a worthwhile reference to the Yosef story. Okay? Alright, so we had someone being sold into slavery. We had a mother, a father and a child going to the same war. Now, that's really not, but it does connect to Parshas Vayeshev, for goodness sakes. It does. He thought she was a Zona, right? He only asks for a Kadesha because to a Canaanite, a Kadesha is not a taboo, right? The all-knowing author of the text says he thought she was a Zona. That's what's in Yehuda's head. But when he asked to give her the thing he had that she took from him, right? He said, tells his friend, where was that Kadesha that was here on the Ayin, right? He doesn't want to say the word Zona. Zona is a taboo in every society in history. But Kadesha is different in Canaan. Kadesha does the same work for the same pay, but she says a bracha, right? It's a holy harlot. Okay, but still, in the story, the father and the son went to the same woman thought to be his owner. And that's what the Haftorah talks about. That's what this talks about. And they're talking about violent clothing. Violent clothing is where you take a mashkon, right? You take collateral from a poor person's clothing what's he going to wear, right? It's violent clothing. In the Torah, in the Vayeshev, there's also a violent act of clothing, right? Where they take his clothes and drench it in blood. But now let's talk about the final connection which we'd like to make at this point. And he speaks about, Rak eschem yodati mikol mishpachos ha'adama. You are my favored people. Right? That plugs into a favored child in the story, right? A teacher's pet. A father's treating one different. What can we as Jews learn from the story of Yosef to avoid the calumnies thrust upon Yosef, where everyone tries to kill him, where we can avoid the same problem of all the nations of the world trying to kill us because we think we're special? Right? That is Amos's goal. And, brilliantly, Louis Rabinowitz in 1946 tries to use the same message. Because listen, remember I told you in the first class we did Amos, that Amos started off in Yehuda and moved to another place to preach there, right? So he says, I'm doing the same. I came from England, and here I have a different perspective of how blacks are treated here in South Africa. Right? So, from the outside, it looks like, I can't believe that you're using business as usual. I can't believe that this makes sense to you. How they treat it. You grew up in this, you were raised in this. Oh, yeah, of course it makes sense that they can't use our parks, and they can't come to our restaurants, and they can't sit at our tables. Because that's your true reason. But that's just crazy. It can't be. In America, that's what was going on also, right? I can't accept it. And it's like almost coming from Tekoa up north and seeing, I can't believe that this is what's going on in Israel. This is acceptable? Right? Okay, so Louis Rabinowitz becomes Amos. Right? And he can't help but speak against what he sees. And if you want this favorite status of being a chosen nation, let me tell you how to navigate and to not fall under the calumnies and or worse that were visited upon Yosef. Remember, 1946, we had just experienced something which was certainly a culmination of centuries and centuries of hatred, not only from the standpoint of Germans, how were they capable of doing this? A much greater philosophical question is, how did the rest of the world let that happen? How did the rest of the world watch this? We know now that everybody knew there were lines, miles long of people being marched into and then not coming out. They had reconnaissance. And huge anti-Semites in British government were crying out saying there is a catastrophic, I can't believe you're laughing at something, who's doing it? Catastrophic death is being visited on women and children on long lines. We see them. We're taking pictures of them. And that went on for a year and no one did it. But the Germans were capable of alright, historians are still sorting that out. But the whole rest of the world, you are the German, the rest of the world are Jews. And Amos is going to teach us that if you had to choose between being on one of those three, best to be on the Jews, even if you're going to lose 6 million of them. But it's 1946, and Louis Rabinowitz is assessing all of this and saying, are we going to do this again? And he doesn't mean to say that we caused this hatred, that we brought it upon ourselves. No. It's not what it is. Hitler was going to visit the same destruction on Christianity, by the way. That was part of his plan. Maybe not in his lifetime, but ultimately. Christians just bought in. Okay? Anyone with a conscience was going to be destroyed. Okay? So, how can we simultaneously say, I am the chosen one, I'm the favorite of Yaakov, and yet not get the jealousies of the others? Can you figure it out? What must the Jew do in order to have that not visited upon?
Yeah. Be humble and not brag about
himself. To be sure. Anything else? That's the first thing. not never even mention it.
Yeah, don't rub it in.
Don't even act as if though that's true. Right? So now I take you to an amazing Gemara in Rav Soloveitchik's. It's so amazing. This is such a crucial Gemara for you to know. The Gemara says that when Yosef finally identified himself to his brothers, right? That he did it again. He gave Binyamin far more money than he gave them. He gave each one of them one change of garments, and Binyamin five changes of garments. Right? And the Gemara in Megillah says, what is going on here? How can you possibly think that this is a smart thing to do? This is what got you in trouble. So, right, you can argue, the Mephoshim asked this question, you can argue, well, you know, it's Yaakov still doing it. Right? But the brothers have somehow been softened not to say something like, Dad, don't you realize that the way you're behaving with Binyamin now by not letting us go back with him, since that's what that guy there wants, that you're behaving in the same way again, right? This time with another son of Rachel, right?
But at this point, there was a higher level of maturity and a different circumstance.
Okay, they're older, they've been through a lot more, they see their father in a different way, the book is ending, we have to fix the breaks already between brothers. All right, I get it. But the Gemara gives an amazing answer. And when the Gemara gives an answer like this, you always have to read through it and see deeper into what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara says that the five garments that Yosef gave to Binyamin were predicting a story of a descendant of his, Mordechai, who would be driven through the streets of Shushan, and it says that Haman gave him, lo and behold, look at the pasuk, five garments to wear on the horse. The five garments to Binyamin were a precursor to the story of Mordechai. Now, please understand, when you read a Gadol like that in the Gemara, of course the author of such an Gadol does not mean to take this literally. It is true, he gave him five, when everyone else got one, and Mordechai has five. What's the connection? What do you think? Yes?
Joseph gave him five, or his dad gave him five?
Joseph gave
everyone
one, but he gave him Binyamin five. The Meshech Chochmah has a brilliant exposition of why he gave Binyamin 300 pieces of silver. It's amazing, but I'm not going to leave it. I'm going to leave it. It's supposed to be like atonement for the fact that they sold him. But I'll put that aside. Here's what Rav Soloveitchik explained. He said, do you think anyone in Shushan was jealous of Mordechai as he's riding through the streets? Any Jew in Shushan is going to say, why is Mordechai getting all this attention? Of course not. Just saved their lives. Right? So why wouldn't someone say that? It's obvious. Mordechai's helping us. That's it. That's the secret. Not just to be humble and never tell anyone that you think you're special, but to make sure that those who are around you, yeah, and I think Jews have done a very good job of this, but the haters still bring out what they'll bring out, right? But to make sure that those around us know, just imagine how flourishing the Middle East could be if everyone around there just acknowledged, well, let the Jews have this little sliver of land, right, which is 1/200th of the size of the Arab world. Well, let them have this little sliver of land, and we'll work together at blooming this area. Right? Look at the disarray the Arab world is in because they can't get on with helping themselves. They're so busy trying to take us down. And the fact that this tiny little sliver is doing so well must be because the old canard of the protocols of the elders of Zion and others, that it must be because they're doing so under nefarious, but they write to their own people, either because we're engaging in witchcraft and magic, or because we have a cabal for the whole world, we're taking over the world. That's the only way to explain it. Right? That may be the most logical thing for an Egyptian on the street, or a Tunisian, or an Algerian, or even a Moroccan. Right? Because that's what they're taught. And they accept it. Right? So, I don't know, you bang yourselves in the head. What the Gemara is saying is that just as no one looked at Mordechai that way, no one looked at Binyamin that way. Right? Binyamin was seen by the brothers as someone who's going to help us. with whatever we have to do with this newly found Yosef character. What's going to do to us? They thought after father died that he'd kill them. Remember? What a sad part of the story. That they still thought after all they've been through. They were there 17 years already. But they still thought maybe Yosef is going to kill us now that daddy's gone. Binyamin was necessary for all of that. In other words, we have to act in a way, Amos is going to tell us in this chapter, that not only hides or was humble about the fact that we're the favored one, right? But that everybody around us should know that their life is better because of us. Without pointing that out, by the way. That's known as Kiddush Hashem, right? Okay, fine. So Hashem says, "Rak ischem yodati mikomish b'chos adama okein if kol aleichem is kol av nosechem." That's a responsibility. I'm holding you more responsible. Okay. All right. So I'm just going to read an Ibn Ezra on this. Eli, ask about you here.
Yeah.
Eli, please.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Read Ibn Ezra to pasuk bet. Rak ischem ke omer.
Yeah.
Ibn Ezra gives two interpretations of what Amos is trying to say.
Which one is it?
Ibn Ezra, Pasuk Bet. It says on the top, Ibn Ezra, Rak Eschem. I even tell you, I told you on the side what it's about.
Okay. Oh.
Okay, well, he writes out and he skips right through. Go, please.
Okay, oh God. Rakashem Komer Yadati Miko Av Vichem Vatsalti Eschem Vataka Sheta Duni Miratem Via Kane Fkor.
Okay, stop there. Now we only have the history of our people throughout CS Mitzrayim till almost. So we know all the times in Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel, we take it that this is our history. So we know how many times God came to save us, right? Now, I've got to tell you, if you are a Sumerian, well, Sumerian's gone by now, but if you're a Philistine, right? The problem is that Philistines also know how to write history. It's just that we don't have any of it, right? But I assure you of this. I'm using Philistines on purpose. Based on stories that we have in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Dalet and Hey, when they took our Haron, right? That when a Philistine is spared from his whatever he suffered through, he also writes, "My God was there with for me, and He saved me, and He took me out." Right? In fact, there's a good reason to use Philistines as an example from this very book, because in chapter 9, when Amos says, "Why do you think you're so special? Because I took you out of Egypt?" Really? Well, let me tell you this. Right? Let me point out to you, Hello is Yisrael, Hello is Yisrael, Mitzrayim. You think that you're so special because I took you out of Egypt? Well, please shimmy Kaftor. The Philistines also have a story when they were enslaved by Kaftorites. That's before the Torah. Right? And they broke the yoke off the Kaftorites. Alright? Okay, so what makes you think you're so special? They can think they're special too. Alright? Look, we don't have Philistine records and documents. We just have this one pasuk in Amos. And what Ibn Ezra is saying is that because you have a history with me, guys. You owe me. It's a karas atov. What do we owe God? We owe God His reputation. Because when we sell people into slavery, because they can't pay back debt. And that goes on for Jewish law, right? What do you think gets into the papers? You know what I'm saying here? What do you think they're going to say? And a people's reputation is their God's reputation. So Amos tells the people, he's not going to stand for this much longer. Right? Yeah, it's a terrible chilul Hashem if he allows your places and your temples to be destroyed. Whoever does it is going to say they defeated the God of Israel. Right? But that's, I don't care. God's a big boy, He can handle that. That nation is in turn going to be destroyed soon too. But what I will not stand for is that my reputation is sullied by your behavior. So That's the difference. Every nation is known by its God, for goodness sakes. Right?
Isn't that the same thing, though, saying that your reputation is going to be like ruined because they're sinning and then they can be destroyed? Isn't that the same thing? It's like saying that, what you just said before, that you said that he doesn't care that they're going to say, oh, look, we destroyed the God of Israel. So,
okay, this is where God is different than the God of Israel is different than other nations. Other nations don't destroy their own people. We don't have any archaeological threats. We don't see any threats in whatever we find from Sumeria, Egypt, Babylon, that the God says, if you don't start acting morally, I'm going to destroy you. What we do find is, if you don't feed me in a virgin job, I'll be weakened, and then you're going to lose your next war. That the gods say all the time. You follow me? I need more babies. I didn't get enough babies this year. So have more babies and give me your first one. Right? Look at this, people have more and more children. And, you know. Okay, so that we find plenty of. Alright? Okay, now read the second interpretation, Ellie.
Alright.
Okay, now you have to know what that's referring to. The Krovi Ekodesh. That's your Krovi Ekodesh. These are the words that God spoke explaining why Nadav and Abihu were killed. You all know what I'm talking about, right? Aaron's two sons in Parsha Shmini, right? Bikrovai Ekodesh. Explain. Bikrovai Ekodesh. Right, I hold you responsible because you're closer. It's obvious. You're hurt most by the people you're closest to. You are my reputation. Not the Sumerians. Right? So of course I care more about what you do. You following? Your son and the neighbor's son is causing mischief. You're not going to discipline the neighbor's son. What he does is not a reflection on you. You following? Alright, so that's what he means by this the Krovai HaKodesh. Pesukim all over Tanakh say this. Hashem is like a chut hasara, like a hair. Red, go ahead.
Ukaha derech hamalachim lekaos al avdeyam ha'amdim lefneyam sheyadu min ha'adim yoter min ha'akparim.
I haven't even as who knows this, but this time it's true. Yeah, explain. Okay, well, I'm going to take class time on this. You should look at this before. The king has close compatriots in his presence. He expects more of them for the reward of being in the presence of the king to know what goes on around here. I'm not going to hold Kfariim responsible. People who live out in the suburbs. People who live near me, I'm holding more responsible. I get angry with them to a greater extent. Right? In other words, you get to enter God's inner chambers, so I expect more of you. Okay, let's go on. What comes now in this from Pasuk Gimel and on is a series of rhetorical questions. Right? Pasuk Gimel, Rabbi Yosef Kara interprets these rhetorical questions to refer to current events of the time. If anyone who reads Amos chapter 3 can move the chapter to his own time period. Right? I always do this as an exercise. And it's not, look, are we going through tumultuous times now? Maybe we are. Right? But let's see what the rhetorical questions are. We'll address them to Amos and see if we can figure out what they mean to us today. Can two people walk side by side and one is not aware of the presence of the other? Does a lion roar in the forest if he doesn't have prey? This is sort of 2A and 2B. It's two lion whelps. One is the lion that roars upon prey that he's about to. He wants to make the prey scared, so he roars and then he's about to pounce on it. And two, hayitain kfir kolo mima'onoso biltiin lachod. Does a kfir, which is usually a young lion, does he leave his Does he give his voice from his den, on the Sosa's den, unless he captured some, caught some prey? Amos knows how lions eat. They go out, they capture prey, they bring it back to their den, and they share it. Right? Only lions do that. Okay, most other animals, except for wolves, especially in the cat world, travel in small groups, right? Because they're very catty. They fight, right? But the lion is different. Okay, so has he called Tzipor al Pacha Oretz Mokei Shema? Does a bird fall to the ground if it's not caught in a net? Hanayalet Pach Min Adamah V'Lachot Lo Yukod? You know how they used to catch animals that it was something attached to a tree and if something came into it, it would pick it up and it would be stuck in a net, right? A trap. Does an animal fall into a trap like that if it's not caught? Okay, finally, this is 1, 2, 8, 3, 3, and 4. In Yitokash Shofar Be'ir, Am Lo Yecharadu, if the shofar is blown, don't you think the people should be scared? In Tiyera O Be'ir, Hashem Lo Asah, this is 4a and 4b, if bad things start to happen, shouldn't you attribute it to God, especially when someone predicts it? You see, bad things are about to happen, but you see, the people are going to say, that's not God. That's not God. That's just happening. Don't tell me that this is a sign that I should be more moral. It's just happening. So Amos is trying to say through these four rhetorical questions that how are you not reading the handwriting on the wall with what's happening in the world? That I'm telling you as a prophet sent by God that you can do something about it. I'm not saying taking up a sign and protesting. I'm saying just improve your own self. Improve your lives. Improve the lives of those around you. And that'll be enough. So what do these four mean? Can you walk next to someone and not know that they're there? What does that mean? You see, what does a scientist do? Scientists studies cause and effect, right? Is B the result of A, right? Or is it just two unconnected events? There is a fallacy of reasoning called post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means after this, therefore because of this. That's not always true. But the prophet is telling you that what's coming down the line now with Ashur is a direct consequence of your misbehavior. There is no standard of morality in the world yet, outside of Judaism. There is none. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be I'm segula on you with this, but that's just a fact. Right? So almost, you see, when Ahav covets a vineyard and his wife arranges for that man, the owner of the vineyard, who doesn't want to give it to him. You don't know the story by now, you should have read it earlier. And Ahab refuses to give him it, and his wife arranges for false testimony to have that man killed, right? For all of Ahab's terrible trespasses, this is the thing that takes down his kingdom, right? His wife, Izebel, princess of Sidon, is just behaving like a good Canaanite. The chief god of Canaan at that time is called Baal Chamod. But the Baal that covets. A good, powerful Canaanite covets and takes. It's Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic. The interest of the stronger. You're stronger right now. Your interest is the definition of virtue. Nothing wrong with that to a Tzidonite. But this takes down the kingdom of an Israelite. And Amos is saying, how could you guys not see what is so apparent? You could try to fly away, you're going to get caught. You could try to whelp and be a lion roaring because Israel was very strong at this time, guys. You know that. We've said that already. Right? Borders were extensive. You can roar like a lion, you can fly like a bird. You will be taken down. The shofar is about to blow. And that's not a shofar of redemption. It's the shofar of destruction. Okay? So that's the fourth thing. So what can I say? You know, do we not see the handwriting on the wall? No, because look, we're not Jeremiahs. And Jeremiah is a short prediction of gloom from what's happening. No, we should have a sunny disposition. We should hopefully things will be better. Things will always be better, right? We're free. We can do what we want, right? But Amos says that's not the case here. The inevitabilities are right in front of you. Okay. It's a crucial question. God would never do these things without giving you a clear sign of nevuah of how to avoid them. Guys, you see the pasuk Zion is so crucial, right? God would not do any of these things if he did not consider that there's a way to avoid it, right? And that's me. I don't love this mission. I know I'm getting beaten up. People don't like me. They're about to try to kill him soon. Right? But God revealed this to me, and I have to say it. I left my home to say it. Right? The way Hashem tells Avram about what he plans to do with Sodom. God doesn't just strike down. There's a warning. Arye Sha'og mi lo yirah. Adonai Elohim diber mi lo yinoveh. The lion is roaring. That lion is probably metaphorically Assyria. They're gaining in strength. Aram is not our problem anymore as much. Our problem is Ashur. It's 1928 and Germany is maybe 1931, maybe 1933. But how could you not see where the world is going? Right? Even as late as 1937, France and England could have taken out Germany in a second. And if they had done it, you could be sure they would have been condemned as warmongers around the whole world. Right? Okay. So you see it? Hashem has spoken, who cannot but prophesy? This is the last pasuk of the Haftarah. Now, can you tell me how this pasuk, I think, cements it. This is so obviously Pashas Vayeshev. Hashem diber mi lo yinoveh. Because Yosef's dreams were fully prophetic. Why is he dreaming about the sun, the moon, and the stars, and about farming implements? They're not farmers, they're shepherds. He should have been dreaming about 12 sheep bowing down to him, or 12 shepherds' staffs bowing down to him. Why are you dreaming about the sun, the moon, and the stars, and about farming? 12 sheets of grain. That's not their business. They bought their grain. Explain to me. Also, I'm celebrating. Beautiful. What does it show, Joseph's preoccupation?
Wasn't the grain because of the starting and the here?
Quite so. In other words, Yosef is telling his brothers, we are going to have to engage. We are going to have to engage Egypt, or whatever Egypt represents. We're going to have to be out there. It's a famous Torah Umada, you know, why you kind of Torah that the rug fell back in the 40s. The brothers said, no, we're just here, Shem, Abraham, we're in our yeshiva, so Yosef said, no, we're going to go into the Gullus, we're the fourth generation. We're gonna be in another place. It looks like Egypt to me. That's my prediction. Because in Egypt, they're astrologers and they're farmers. They're not gonna get by as shepherds. We have to learn how to be like them. So the brother said, okay, we'll sell you there. It's not so much. Obviously, that's not borne out fully by the text itself. But what they're telling him is that we disagree with your assessment that we have to engage the outside world in order to survive there, to thrive there. And Yosef said, you know, obviously Yosef is the one who wins. If not the Yosef, they all starve, right? Okay. So that's what it says. Hashem diber mi lo yinoveh. Yosef knows it's immature of him to speak about his dreams, but God has spoken. I have to say these words. You get it? It's not just he's dreaming about you bowing down to me, which of course is prophetic, profoundly prophetic, right? remembered his dreams when they ended up bowing down to him. Right? Ramban says that's why he had to get Binyamin. Because without Binyamin there, no.
Without Binyamin there, they can't go.
The dream isn't fully true. It's 12 stars. Right? 11 stars. Right? He wants the dream to be fully true. Right? That's Ramban. I'm not sure I agree with this, but okay. Alright, so this is Arikara on these rhetorical questions. And the purpose of the shofar and the Mitsudos is to say, you think the shofar is a sign of redemption. Uva shofar go yitzakar and yishayo berchazayim. Uva oho de beretashra and yidoch and beretashra and yidoch and beretashra and yidoch and beretashra and The shofar has a lot of images. Remember, Sadi Gaon's 10 reasons for blowing shofar. One is about redemption, but one is also about destruction. Remember, this could be a bad day for you. Make sure it's a good day. Rosh Hashanah. Right?
Okay. Can you get back to what John Bond said?
I can't. Okay. So this is the last pasuk in Haftorah by Yishev. God has spoken. Who cannot give prophecy? Yosef actually, according to the Rav, felt that his dreams were not only prophetic about him. Right? His mistake was in not having the brothers see how their life could be much better as a result of him. You see, in Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov knows immense secrets about shepherding, right? Peeling the sticks and the water and then looking at each other, right? Yaakov must have been just the kind of secrets that the Egyptians had in building 3,000 years ago with the trigonometry and calculus. That we didn't know until recently. So Yaakov knew some shepherding secrets that he shared only with Yosef. Yosef gets a long, some of his passing is with passes a wrist. He had the long sleeved shirt. He didn't have to work out in the field with the others because he was smarter. Yaakov saw that in him. So he shared all of his shepherding secrets with Yosef. And Yosef tries. He tries to make his brothers' lives better as a result of what he knows. Think of the words. Who wrote Esechov Batson, Sforno says. He tried to teach these secrets to his brothers, and they said, we're not learning any secrets from our youngest brother. You have nothing to teach us, buddy. Get out of here. Right? He tried. He always tries to be helpful. That's Yosef. He tries to be helpful with the baker and the butler. He tries to be helpful with power. And he's profoundly religious. God's in the middle of everything for him. Hashem Diber, he really feels that God is telling him these things. How can I keep it to myself? He just didn't do a good enough job of convincing them that their lives could be made better the way Mordechai did and the way Binyamin does later with that five thing we spoke about. That's our challenge as a people, to make everybody around us to recognize that your shul is here and everything around it is being improved as a result. I think we do that pretty well. It's just that I don't know if we're good at making other people recognize. We bring prosperity wherever we go. Never mind that. Do you know how many Nobel prizes we've won and how many? I mean, 12 million Jews, and we have something like 40 times the Nobel prizes as 1.5 billion Muslims. Right. So, again, that's just for us here. Shouldn't gloat about these things outside, but I'm just saying, be proud of ourselves, okay? Alright, but we're always looking over our shoulders. The rest of the parak talks about how few will survive. He speaks in metaphorically like a sheep that is devoured by a lion. What are you going to find left? A piece of the ear? Right? A little piece of cartilage? Right? How much is going to survive that they're not going to devour? These are threats, the end of Perek Gimel, about how much the lion is going to, he's just going to leave behind some knees. He's going to eat a knee. A kneecap is not there. There's just cartilage there. The lion isn't going to even want to eat that. Right? It's supposed to be bet. They cry and bedalos and a little piece of the ear. And it just hit me for the first time. What does the ear and the knee have in common? Cartilage. No one wants to eat that. You ever see the cartilage of the chicken? Who wants to eat that part? It's not edible. Right?
Well, cartilage.
Yeah, maybe just, that's the two things, the part that the lion doesn't eat, the knee and the legs of and part of the ear. And he says that's all that they'll leave behind. Right? So he says, listen to this, because You know, they're going to rip you apart, and I will take out your summer homes with your winter homes at the same time. That's the last possible prayer. Come on, what we'll do with her, you know? I'll take out your summer homes and your winter homes together at the same time. What could possibly do that? Talk about this, remember? An earthquake. It'd be a storm too, but a storm that goes into this, that destroys the summer home in the north, usually doesn't make it to the south. So Israel has a huge disparity in weather on the same day. You could see snow in parts of Israel, and you could see 100 degrees in parts of Israel on the same day. Right? So, and it's a small country. So this earthquake is a test, and he's going to mention it specifically later. Okay, please, Rashi makes this reference. This last Rashi on the page. Please make sure that you have your what we did. We're going to do prepare Talmud. Okay, for next class, and we're going to move on. All right, today is the 29th, I believe.
Do you have an extra sheet of that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's going to be here on the table, okay? Joseph Benaderet?
Here.
Daniel Ariyah?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, this is
Salman Baria? Joseph Cohen?
Here.
Ari Drazen?
Here.
Michael Brunner?
Yeah.
No, it's not bad. It's
Ariel Gabbard? Emil Gabbard? James Goldstein? Jared Coben? Ariel Gutman? Isaac Jacobson? Zach Katz?
Here.
Tobi Marks?
Here.
Jesse Margaret? Jesse? Nathan Myers?
Here.
Steve Downberg?
Here.
Paul Rosenberg? Jacob Finkel? Morris Sitt?
Yeah.
Ari Strauss?
Yeah.
Avi Aaron Siegel? Eliezer Sandel? David Siegel? Michael Tawil?
Here.
John Turo?
Here.
Alex Hepler?
Here.
David Yedlin?
Yeah.
Josh Stavsky? Eli Asba?
Yeah.
Kiva Rube?
Yeah.
Caleb Angel?
Yeah.
Gabe Saffron?
Yeah.
Mason Wedgel?
Yeah.
Jonathan Kolb?
Kiva.
Jonathan Zell?
Yeah.